Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. And in this podcast, I share observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I'm joined by Matt Savino, Global Head of Carlyle's Capital Markets team, who is here to talk about capital markets, something he knows quite a lot about. We're going to talk about what he's seen today and also some of the broader trends in deal financing and also private credit. This episode was recorded on March 10th, 2025, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. Before I get to Matt, just a word about what we're seeing. So as I mentioned, we're recording March 10th, 2025, and there was a fairly sizable sell-off in the equity markets. And so far, year to date, the S&P 500 is down by about 4.5%. The Russell Small Cap Index down about 9%. And the NASDAQ is down about 10% year to date and off about 14% from its all-time highs. So interesting market action to start our conversation today. You know, I would say first off that much of this sell-off that we've seen year to date, at least in 2025, has been U.S. specific. If you look at outside of the United States, year-to-date returns are about 6% positive. So a fairly sizable gap has opened between indexes and the rest of the world relative to those in the United States. And in particular, outperformance has been observed in Greater China. The Hang Seng Index up about 20% year-to-date. Also, strong outperformance in Germany, about 14% year-to-date, with broader Euro stocks 600 up about 8%. And so I think that there's some significance here. As we noted in our Compass contribution from March 4th of 2025, the U.S. valuations have risen to levels that are, you know, materially higher than elsewhere in the world. You also have, of course, investors, stock market investors, allocations to the U.S. that look, if not out of whack, you know, certainly elevated relative to historical allocations and also relative underlying contributions of earnings and GDP. In addition, of course, entering the year, you also had a U.S. dollar that on a real effective basis was higher than it's been really since the mid-1980s. So again, we have, I think, a tendency to see markets selling off and assume it's a global phenomenon. But to a large extent, it is U.S. specific and perhaps, again, related to some of these valuation allocation issues. When we looked at our February portfolio data, looking at key performance indicators, in general, you know, there's a lot of noise. There was no clear signals that anything had really fundamentally changed in terms of trend growth rates that we're observing in the U.S. economy. And I think that the employment report that came out from the Bureau of Labor Statistics was generally consistent with that. If you looked at payroll employment growth, if you looked at the unemployment rate, if you looked at average wage growth, it's all, you know, generally consistent with what we've been observing over the last 4 to 5 months. However, there was one area of note, and that was our indicators for industrial demand suggested that the underlying manufacturing sector in the U.S. went from essentially flat, you know, almost 0% growth in the fourth quarter of 2024 to growing at over 5% in the first 2 months of the year. Now, that wasn't actually happening. Those signals were really about the management teams recognizing the risk of tariffs and front-loading deliveries of components, parts, equipment, raw materials, other items, other inputs that they need, and doing so in advance, again, of any tariffs taking effect. So again, that was interesting. And I think there's two issues related to this planning for tariffs. The first, I do think that this is going to lead to some potentially significant volatility in the official data. So, you know, when you think about imports, of course, they subtract from GDP. So, you know, if you have this big surge in imports of intermediate goods and raw materials, that's going to be negative for the national income measures. Now, in general, inventories contribute to GDP, but those are only inventories of finished goods. So, you know, Ford makes a new F-150 and it goes out to dealer lots, that counts for GDP. If they just took possession of, in advance of production, raw materials like aluminum or steel or circuit boards, that sort of thing, that does not count towards GDP. So a lot of this is just what had been acquired in this sort of front running of tariffs, and we'll see what sort of impact it has. You could have a very bad Q1 and then a bounce back in Q2. We'll see. But I think that as people are more concerned about the economy, as people have become more concerned about the potential of recession, you do have this complication that the official data is not going to provide a very clear signal. And this is, I think, going to create challenges in terms of what's real in the data from what is just an artifact of the data because of the tariffs. The second point I would make related to the front loading, you know, it's amazing the conversations that I have with management teams, particularly in the industrial sector, but lots of other areas as well, just how much of their time is being consumed by the contingency planning for tariffs. Sometimes I'm just like, wow, so you must 20, 30% of your time is just devoted to, again, thinking about what's going to be tariffed, the products, the inputs that you need, thinking about the pricing implications, to what extent can you push on price, and where is the ultimate cost going to be borne? And I think that this, to me, it kind of feels similar to compliance costs. When you have a new regulation that takes effect and you think about the people that need to be hired or the attention that it consumes, that is something that I think is really happening here. That instead of being focused on the business or how to grow the business or just the corporate strategy, a lot of time has been, I think, consumed again by thinking through tariffs. So we'll see. And then secondly, even beyond that, you do ultimately have this question of what tariffs are going to take effect and what is the magnitude going to be. But as we've said in previous episodes, it does feel like a market that at one point was just very focused on the inflationary implications. What is the rise in the price level going to be and what impact does that have on consumer sentiment and perhaps the upward move in interest rates? Today, I think very obviously a market that has come to terms with the potentially contractionary effect of the price shock associated with tariffs, and actually the likelihood, if large tariffs were going to take effect, that the next move in rates would be down, you know, sort of looking through a temporary increase in the price level and instead focused on any potential damage they have on GDP. So again, at this point, I think it's premature to really suggest that there's really been any material change in the trajectory of the U.S. economy. We'll see how policy evolves. My only concern, again, the fact that there's been this front loading adding to volatility, but again, I think more importantly, really just revealing the extent to which management teams' time and attention has been diverted from higher value added uses. So with that, I'd like to turn to Matt. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jason. Good to be here.
So, you know, obviously with the equity market, stock market volatility that we're seeing, my first question really, and your role for the most part, you can describe it if you'd like, but for the most part, it's obtaining the best potential financing package for our portfolio companies and really just serving that function. Actually, well, why don't we just start with you giving a brief description of your role and the team that you had?
Great. And that's a fair description. Our primary job is to work with our investors internally, and we work across private equity in both corporate private equity, but also infrastructure, renewables, real asset oriented space, and then credit as well. So we work with our investors internally, and to the extent there's financing related to our investment activity that touches the capital markets, whether it's public or private or debt or equity, our team partners with those investors and brings, you know, expertise to the table. Our job is to be in the markets every day. We operate globally. We have folks on our team in the US, as well as sitting in London who focus on Europe and Asia. So we operate across geographies, we operate across products, and we're solely focused, you know, on those markets so that when our partners on the investing side need to bring that expertise to the table, we have it internally.
So what are you seeing today in these capital markets, markets for deal finance, given the volatility that we see obviously in the stock markets? Has that spilled over into the area that you play in?
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting couple of weeks here in the markets. You've seen a lot of volatility on the equity side. You described it well as far as the market, I think, coming to terms with the risk to the growth outlook after a period kind of post-inauguration of having a lot of exuberance about pro-growth policies. I think the policy mix certainly has pluses and minuses, and I think the market is in a period here of maybe rebalancing and repricing it. And look, you can't lose sight of the fact that a month ago, we were dealing with equity markets that were setting new highs. So you had a very tightly wound market, and now the weight of uncertainty is leaning on those markets. And as a result, in the last couple of weeks, you've seen kind of a material shift in positioning in the market. And, you know, as that happens to tightly wound markets, it can be painful at times to experience. But, you know, it is a reweighting. You're seeing outperformance for some of the more defensive sectors. Healthcare, consumer staples are obviously outperforming technology and consumer discretionary type markets. So there's rebalancing, there's de-risking, and we'll just have to kind of see what the markets take us. But on the equity side, it doesn't necessarily undermine what we see as a market that's going to be receptive to more IPO activity this year. There's volatility to consider, but when we talk to the real money players out there, and we've had a number of IPOs in the last several months in the US, in India, in Japan, we think that the theme of interest out of those big institutional players will hopefully continue here. We'll just have to see how some of this volatility shakes out. Credit markets have been a much more muted response to that volatility of late. The loan market in particular, which is really the lifeblood of what we do within private equity, it's the primary market that we access. Some of the steam came out of that market, but you know, it had been in one of the longest repricing waves I've seen in my career. What you're seeing there today, a lot of the names that came that priced on the tight end of the spread spectrum relative to their rating quality, you know, those things are off quarter to half a point, but the primary market is still very much open. I think there were $23 billion worth of deals just last week, despite the volatility. So things are certainly functioning more muted on the credit side. Obviously, you can't ignore the macro reset, and I'm sure a lot of credit managers are looking across their portfolio and deciding where they want to be, but you know, the volatility has been much lower.
You talked about a tightly wound market, and I thought that was an interesting description. When these sorts of sell-offs happen, you have those analysts, strategists, who really want to say this is all technicals, and cash holdings were so low that there was very little upside, that this sell-off is really just, again, precipitated by some of these technical factors. And then, of course, you have those who have any time the market dips by 1% or 2%, start calling for a recession, or again, suggesting that the market is anticipating that. Given that things have been so muted in credit markets in terms of the spillover, would that make you lean more on the technical side here in terms of explaining the sell-off, or how do you interpret what you're seeing?
I think that's right. I mean, the leveraged finance markets, there are technical aspects to it, and certainly some of the dampened or muted experience of the loan market relative to the equity market is driven by the fact that the loan market has its own technicals, and the demand side technicals have been very good. CLO creation has been very good. You know, spreads were a little bit wider, but you know, there's money on the demand side of the market, which obviously will, you know, limit the overall volatility. But I think what you're getting at is right. You know, the equity market has, you know, pretty sizable momentum, systematic type players relative to the credit market. So when I'm looking at, you know, volatility, and I'm looking at the influence of macro events on markets, and this may be a little bit of a bias to how I grew up in the business, but I tend to look at the credit market reaction to those sorts of things, because there just tends to be, you know, a little bit less of the volatility that's, you know, driven by some of the technicals relative to the equity market.
Yeah, I always think of the credit markets as the canary in the coal mine also. You know, and we can think about the GFC, where equity markets were still performing pretty well, well beyond the point where people recognized that there had been pretty serious disruption. So that is a very interesting point that you make. And when you think also about the credit markets and the way that they've evolved, you had a really interesting Compass article very recently, and talking about this golden age of financing. And part of it, of course, was spreads, right? You have spreads that are extraordinarily tight, but a lot of it was also the diversity of funding sources, the different sorts of capital that you can access. And I wonder if you wanted to just talk about that and sort of the menu of options that you have today.
Sure. And what you're specifically referencing is the rise in private credit. So private credit's been around for a very long time. Historically, though, it was more focused on that small, medium-sized business type borrower, and the scaled businesses on the private equity side and even in corporate America tended to go to the loan and high yield market, the publicly syndicated markets. And what you saw, kind of the end of last decade is private credit raising capital to lend to the more scaled businesses that, historically went public. And they started doing that just before COVID. And obviously, there was a lot of volatility around COVID. But then you had this period of markets began to return. Then you had the impact of inflation and the Fed starting to increase rates materially and the volatility that came with that. So you kind of had private credit starting to move up market and then a lot of volatility in the market, where the nature of private credit and the fact that it's driven by stickier money put it in a position to really do a lot of business when public markets were more difficult to access. And that really supercharged growth for all these players within the private credit markets. And, that market at this point has grown to, I think the last number, it's a little bit hard to get your handle around the perfect number, but call it $1.7 trillion versus loan and bond markets that are in that $1.3 trillion to $1.5 trillion area. So private credit has grown to a point where it's very similarly sized to loans and bonds. And, along the way here, there's been a number of articles written, you've seen it in the press, where it talks about the convergence of private credit and the loan market. And I've never really loved that terminology, only because it sounds like private credit is here to replace the loan market. But from our perspective, from the seat that I sit in, it's really just another tool in the toolkit. I mentioned there are different demand drivers in private credit relative to the loan market in particular. Loan markets are driven, most of that demand, 65% of that demand comes from CLOs and the remainder from retail funds and separate accounts that people manage. And private credit, there's BDCs, there's separate accounts, there's, fund structures that are just fundamentally different. And when you look at the structure of those products from my seat, it's not just a replacement of loan markets in times of volatility when you think of private credit, but it's a product that really can be used in our business on all weather. So, when you think about doing a complicated carve out, we did one last year for Vantive, which is Baxter's renal care business. This was a global business. It's a complicated carve out. And you think about private credit where you're setting the price up front on that deal when you sign a commitment letter with your lenders. You can choose different currency options. It's easier to have currency options in that market relative to the public market. So in that deal, we had US dollar, CAD, and Japanese yen. And you think about, being in a non-rated environment where, your loans aren't going to trade and you don't have to worry about that quarter-to-quarter volatility. You have partners alongside of you. So it's a very attractive product for even just certain kinds of deals. And there's a number of other examples that I could provide, but private credit is just a tool that's different than the public markets, but we do plenty in the public market still too. And, for some of our more scaled players, it's going to continue to be the better option. So where I sit today, we just have a lot more options to go finance the businesses based on the profile of the acquisition we're doing.
So it sounds like the private credit is a lot more bespoke. There's flexibility to work with you in terms of the currency mix, as you mentioned, and just other dynamics of the deal. With the public markets, you have to sort of deliver something to what the end market wants. Is that a sort of a fair characterization?
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I think the way we view private credit is it's a strategic market. It's a market that we engage with strategically. We tend to do a fair amount of business with a certain segment of the market. We show them a lot of deals. We're very important to them as they grow their businesses. And when we're looking at a new acquisition, if there's specific tailoring we need or specific currencies or problems we want to solve up front in our financing, it's easier to have that dialogue because you have a limited number of investors that are going to provide you your whole financing. When you think about the public syndicated markets, there are differences across credit packages for sure. But you're really going to market in a public setting and trying to have that dialogue when your top allocation is only going to be, 5 to 10% of a deal in certain circumstances. So there's just a lot of institutional players on the public side, and you're not necessarily having that intimate, structuring dialogue that you would have in a private setting.
And I know this is a hard question to answer, given that every deal has deal-specific factors. But how much more would you say you pay for the flexibility, for the price certainty, all the other attributes that draw you to private credit? What would you say is sort of the incremental spread that that costs?
So it fluctuates across different market environments. So normally you would say a private credit deal would cost you 75 to 100 basis points more spread across your capital structure than a full capital structure on the public side. So that's under kind of normal environments, what people would say. But in this environment, it's a little bit trickier. And, you know, technicals are such on the private credit side that there might not really be that much of a premium by the time you look across your structure. So, and it's hard to compare things. The other thing to be careful of out there is it's hard to exactly compare the loan market where your attachment point on a first lien might be, you know, and this has increased over time, but call it 5.5 times versus a unitranche in the private credit markets where you're 6.5 to 7 times. So, you know, you have different leverage profile across the two markets. So you can't just exactly look at what spreads you're printing on the public side versus what spreads you're getting on the private credit side. But in a normal functioning world where it's easy to get both senior and junior financing on the public side, it would typically be in the 75 to 100 basis points of spread cost. Now, some of that's offset by you're also probably paying lower all-in upfront costs because you don't necessarily have a bank intermediary going to the private markets. So you do save a little bit to kind of offset the spread differential. So there's some cost to it, but in some markets it's very limited. In other markets it might be more.
Just one more question. Since you mentioned the contrast in the unitranche versus the first lien, how is the junior capital or second lien market? As some private credit market participants started doing unitranche, it seemed like there was perhaps less interest in doing the junior capital. And then some people complained about those spreads kind of blowing out as there was less interest. How is that market right now?
So there's limited data points for the second lien loan market. The second lien loan market's super interesting if you look at it over the arc of time. It used to be a market where you had BDCs or CLOs coming in and, you know, finding the spread to the first lien, you know, attractive, and the market kind of grew up around that. The market today is really one that's, the demand side of it is really total return players. So, you know, we did one last year for one of our companies. We wound up privately placing it, but we were close to doing more of a syndicated format. You've seen syndicated second liens, you know, episodically over the last year, and it's mostly being purchased by high yield players. So folks that look at, even though it's a floating rate product and it has different call protection, total return players that are typically looking at high yield would view the all-in yield attractive on the instrument. And if they know the name, they like the name, you know, they're willing to provide that capital, even though it's not coming in a security, you know, high yield bond format. So it's really evolved to be a product that is replacing what would ordinarily be a high yield bond. And those buyers are willing to do it on a situation that they know well and an issuer that they want to be involved with.
So before you go, just about the current market circumstances, obviously there's not going to be some sort of all clear sign and big neon letters that lets everyone know that there's nothing to worry about here. But is there anything that you would like to see either from a policy perspective or, you know, underlying data, maybe it's the markets, to just feel more comfortable assuming that this is sort of a blip, again, a technically driven repricing, rebalancing, rather than something that's of greater concern?
It seems like we just keep adding to the balls in the air rather than taking some of the balls out of the air before we add other ones. So from a news flow perspective, obviously a little bit more certainty as to the path forward is helpful. I think from a market perspective, you know, you'd like to see a floor established on the equity market side, and that's going to happen when, you know, some of the bigger institutional real money players come into this market when they view it as kind of being the all clear of de-risking. So back to your technical issues, as we discussed before, technical drivers have a natural end. Like you get through that and risk gets to a certain level, and then less volatile players in the market, longer term perspective of the market kind of comes in and helps establish that floor again where, you know, you can gain some confidence that the market has just repriced risk to a point where now it's more attractive. So I think you'll just see that in the daily trading from the equity side. And from the credit markets, you just want to see it, you know, continue to hang in. And I'll be watching fund flows in the next several days to see what we can parse from that. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, as far as the policy makers out there, you know, it's always good to kind of get a better feel and better certainty as the direction of travel. Market obviously does not like and has a hard time pricing a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, that adding more balls in the air. I very much appreciate that. And that was a great way to describe the situation. Well, Matt, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Great. Thanks, Jason. Anytime. Appreciate it.
So as always, thanks for listening. And I hope you'll join us for next month's episode of Insights in Indicators.